From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
In New Orleans, the federal government, despite our huge housing problems, just announced that they're going to destroy 5,000 public housing apartments. And the residents are upset, the community is upset, and it's really time for a fight.
Why is the federal government eliminating thousands of public housing units in New Orleans, while tens of thousands of residents remain displaced? Also, we'll look at the public school system in New Orleans, where all the teachers have been fired and the school board refuses to negotiate with the teachers union. But first, we go to Afghanistan, where U.S.-led forces have launched their largest military offensive since the fall of the Taliban. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The so-called coalition of the willing in Iraq is continuing to shrink. The Japanese prime minister has announced plans to pull 600 troops out of Iraq within weeks. Italy's already said it'll remove its troops by year's end. Spain, the Netherlands, Ukraine, Nicaragua, Philippines, and Honduras have already pulled out. Once Italian troops leave, Britain and South Korea will be the only nations besides the United States to have more than 1,000 troops in Iraq. In other news from Iraq, the two U.S. soldiers missing since Friday have been found dead south of Baghdad. Christian Menchaca of Houston, Texas, and Thomas Tucker of Oregon were the first U.S. soldiers to have been reported missing in action in Iraq in 2 years. A group with ties to al-Qaeda in Iraq called the Mujahideen Shura Council had claimed responsibility for kidnapping the men. Three U.S. soldiers have been charged in connection with the killing of three Iraqi detainees last month in the town of Tharthar Canal. The soldiers, all members of the 101st Airborne Division, reportedly detained three Iraqis during a raid on a former chemical factory. Then the soldiers allowed the Iraqis to flee the scene so they would have an excuse to shoot them. The men are also accused of threatening to kill another soldier if he assisted investigators. Meanwhile, there are reports coming out of the Iraqi city of Baquba that U.S. forces killed 13 Iraqis working in poultry farms during an overnight raid. An Iraqi police officer said the workers were sleeping on the roof of their houses. Four others were wounded in the raid, and 10 people were arrested. Earlier today in Baghdad, a car bomb exploded in a crowded market. 7 people died. 18 people were wounded. In Italy, federal prosecutors are calling for a U.S. Marine to stand trial for the killing of Italian intelligence officer Niccolo Calipari in Baghdad last year. Calipari was escorting Italian journalist Giuliana Screna after she had been released by kidnappers. U.S. troops opened fire on their car, killing Calipari and injuring Screna. The U.S. Marine charged with the killings has been identified as Mario Lozano. Tune into Democracy Now! Thursday when Italian journalist Giuliana Screna joins us in our Firehouse studio. The U.S. Supreme Court has moved a step closer to rolling back the Clean Water Act. A divided court said the landmark 1972 law should only apply to wetlands with a close connection to a river, lake, or some other major waterway. The court was split three ways. Four justices, led by Antonin Scalia, argued to sharply restrict the definition of wetlands. Four justices argued for upholding the law as is, and in the middle was Justice Anthony Kennedy, who argued the law may have been misinterpreted, but he upheld federal control over most wetlands. Kennedy argued that Justice Scalia's opinion was unduly dismissive of the importance of wetlands. Kennedy went on to say Scalia's view was inconsistent with the text, structure, and purpose of the Clean Water Act. The Washington Post is reporting the Bush administration ignored an offer from Iran in 2003 to cooperate on a number of key issues now at the center of the dispute between the two nations. According to the report, Iran offered to fully cooperate on its nuclear program, recognize the State of Israel, and terminate support for Palestinian militant groups. Iran sent the offer just weeks after the U.S. invaded Iraq. The Bush administration belittled the offer and formally complained to the Swiss ambassador for sending the proposal along. Meanwhile, on Monday, President Bush warned Iran again that it will face tough sanctions if it rejects a new offer from the U.S. and European nations to rejoin nuclear talks.
If Iran's leaders reject our offer, it will result in action before the Security Council, further isolation from the world, and progressively stronger political and economic sanctions. I have a message for the Iranian regime. America and our partners are united. We have presented a reasonable offer. Iran's leaders should see our proposal for what it is, an historic opportunity to set their country on a better course.
The United States, Japan, Australia, and South Korea are all warning North Korea not to proceed with test firing a long-range ballistic missile. This is Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice.
So it would be a very serious matter and indeed a provocative act should North Korea decide to launch that missile.
North Korea has responded by lashing out at the Bush administration for moving ahead with plans to build a missile shield. North Korea said the Star Wars-like program could fuel a dangerous arms race in space. In other news from the region, 22,000 U.S. troops and 280 aircraft are taking part in stage war games today in the Western Pacific. The Bush administration is pressuring Latin American nations to prevent Venezuela from securing an open seat on the United Nations Security Council. Under UN rules, Latin American governments are entitled to pick a country from the region to fill the rotating seat that comes open next year. The Los Angeles Times reports the U.S. fears the selection of Venezuela might confound the Bush administration's plans to step up pressure on Iran. U.S. diplomats are threatening nations like Chile with withdrawing support for key projects if they back the selection of Venezuela. One Chilean newspaper reported Secretary of State Rice told her Chilean counterpart that a vote for Venezuela would lump Chile with a group of losers. Brazil, Argentina, Cuba, Bolivia, Uruguay, Paraguay, and several Caribbean nations have already backed Venezuela. The U.S. is lobbying for Guatemala to get the U.N. seat. The BBC has obtained evidence that Afghanistan's intelligence services are putting new restrictions on what Afghan journalists can report. According to a leaked memo, Afghan journalists are no longer allowed to criticize the U.S.-led military coalition or publish interviews against the government's foreign policy. The Afghan media has also been instructed to limit the coverage dedicated to the activities of militants, and there are now prohibitions on interviewing, filming, or photographing men considered terrorist commanders. The government maintains the restrictions are needed to prevent the media from what it describes as glorifying terrorism. A spokesperson for the U.S.-backed President Hamid Karzai said, quote, "This request is entirely consistent with the principles of the freedoms of speech and press enshrined in the Constitution." One news agency chief said 95% of his stories would be banned if these rules and regulations become law. The Knight Ridder News Agency is reporting the Department of Veterans Affairs is on a pace to see nearly 20,000 new cases of post-combat stress this year among service members who served in Iraq and Afghanistan. This is more than six times the number of cases that officials had expected. Meanwhile, The Washington Post is reporting thousands of Vietnam veterans are now seeking help for post-traumatic stress disorder, more than 30 years after their war ended. Experts say one reason appears to be harrowing images of combat in Iraq. This news from Africa. Charles Taylor, the former president of Liberia, has been flown out of Sierra Leone to go on trial for war crimes at The Hague. He faces 11 war crimes charges for backing rebels in the decade-long Sierra Leone civil war that left tens of thousands dead. Last week, Britain offered to hold Taylor in prison if he's convicted by the International Criminal Court. Reports are coming out of the Middle East that Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert plan to meet for the first time on Wednesday in Jordan. On Monday, thousands of Palestinian workers were paid for the first time since March. The money largely came from private donations and Islamic charities. Here in this country, a coalition of consumer, civil rights, labor, and media reform groups are launching a new campaign today. The groups oppose rule changes that would allow large media corporations control to more TV channels, radio stations, and newspapers in communities across the country. The groups are launching a new website today called StopBigMedia.com. The campaign comes as the Federal Communications Commission is preparing to start a new rulemaking process this week that could result in the overhaul of the nation's media ownership rules. The advocacy groups maintain the relaxation of the rules would lead to more corporate consolidation, less competition, and fewer local voices in the media. The governor of Louisiana has ordered the National Guard to return to New Orleans to begin patrolling the city streets following an outbreak in violence. Over the weekend, six people were murdered, and New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin asked the governor for 300 soldiers and 60 state police officers to be deployed. Nagin said the troops are needed to restore law and order.
This is our line in the sand. We are saying we're not going any further.
Mayor Nagin also said the city is considering implementing a curfew for the city's youth. We'll have more on New Orleans later in the program. There's an update in the case of civil rights attorney Lynn Stewart. She's the New York attorney convicted of terror-related charges for her work representing the imprisoned client, Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman. Stewart filed court papers Monday seeking to learn whether any warrantless or illegal electronic surveillance was conducted on her or anyone involved in her case. Stewart maintains the government's case against her would be compromised if it engaged in illegal surveillance. The Bush administration has already admitted it monitored jailhouse conversations between Stewart and her client. And in India, trash collectors in the city of Meerut are staging mass protests in an attempt to gain permanent jobs with benefits. The trash collectors have begun dumping garbage in the city streets and pelting the homes of government officials with filth. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Afghanistan, U.S. forces have launched the largest military offensive since the fall of the Taliban in 2001. More than 10,000 coalition troops are spreading out across southern Afghanistan to fight the Taliban in a campaign called Operation Mountain Thrust. Over the past month, more than 500 people have died in Afghanistan in some of the heaviest fighting of the war. The head of the United Nations assistance mission in Kandahar recently told the New York Times, quote, "The situation is really, in the last 4 years, the most unstable and insecure I have seen." In the latest bloodshed, two Taliban ambushes of civilian convoys left 30 people dead on Tuesday, including 25 members of the same family. Afghan and coalition soldiers killed 11 militants in separate clashes. But much of that news may go unreported within Afghanistan. The BBC has obtained evidence that Afghanistan's intelligence services are putting new restrictions on what Afghan journalists can report. The restrictions include directives not to represent the Afghan armed forces as weak or criticize the U.S.-led coalition. The government maintains the restrictions are needed to prevent the media from what it calls glorifying terrorism. For more on the latest, we go to Afghanistan to speak with journalist Declan Walsh. He's a correspondent for the London Guardian. He joins us on the phone from Kandahar. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Declan. If you can talk about the latest casualties that we're hearing about the 25 members of the same family killed.
That's right. This was an attack in Helmand province yesterday, or rather on Sunday. It appears that a local tribal leader and a small number of his family were traveling through a district called Sangin, which has been the site of some very heavy fighting between the Taliban and coalition forces in recent months. The tribal elder and his family were killed. He told me that approximately 11 people died in the initial ambush, which happened a couple of miles from the town. Some hours later, his relatives came to the site of the ambush to try and retrieve the dead and try to find any wounded. It appears the same Taliban group hit again, killed about another 20 people. So that brings the total death toll to about 32, according to a relative of this man who's a parliamentarian. It's really a sign of how strong the Taliban grip is on pockets of Helmand province and indeed across the wider southern provinces, a grip that has strengthened considerably in the last 3 or 4 months.
Declan Walsh is speaking to us from Kandahar. Can you talk about just overall the situation and the level of civilians caught in crossfire?
The situation, as has been reported to some degree, has really deteriorated quite sharply in the last 6 months in particular. We've seen an increase in Taliban suicide bombings, roadside IED attacks, roadside attacks on American and other foreign troops, and a high number of casualties from Afghan police. In some ways, this seems to be a result of the failure of the Afghan government in some ways. People here are really disillusioned with the failure of the Afghan government to provide basic security and some basic services over the last 4 years. That's feeding into some degree of sympathy for the Taliban. On the other side, the Taliban have led a very successful campaign of infiltration from across the border in Pakistan, and they are intimidating people. I've been going around this morning trying to find some religious leaders, mullahs, who can speak about the Taliban issue. Those who are identified as being pro-government have almost to a man told me that they're too afraid to speak. And I think that speaks volume about how some of the most important leaders in the society are, if you like, afraid to sort of raise their head above the parapet at the moment for fear of assassination or intimidation.
Declan Walsh, this week you wrote a piece entitled Beaten, Robbed, and Exiled, Life on the Front Line of Someone Else's War. Can you describe what you were talking about in Kalat?
This is a story I wrote from Zabul province. It's one of the four provinces that are being targeted under Operation Mountain Thrust, and it's considered to be, or pockets of it are considered to be, Taliban safe havens. In Kalat, which is the provincial capital, I spoke with people who came from one of these areas considered to be Taliban hideouts, who explained to me how, after an attack on a newly built Afghan army base in a mountainous area, the Afghan soldiers went into their houses at dawn, forced them out of their houses, beat the men, searched the house, which is considered a really quite a serious dishonor in this part of the world, and robbed them of some of their possessions. As I explained in the story, it's difficult to confirm, independently verify some of these details because these areas are simply out of bounds, not only for Western journalists, but indeed for Afghan officials who are based in the provincial capital. The story did seem to illustrate how the sort of pressure that these villagers are coming on, because many of the same people admitted that they had also been visited by the Taliban, who had come to them demanding shelter, demanding food, and threatening to kill them if they didn't cooperate. So it seems that in these rural areas that really have are very lightly touched by the foreign forces, have virtually no central government presence, people are coming under enormous pressure from both sides, really, to cooperate.
Yet, Declan, you write that Taliban tactics fuel anti-Western feeling. Why?
Here in Kandahar, there's been a whole spate of bombings over the last number of months. The most recent one was a bus bombing on the edge of town about 4 days ago, in which a number of people were killed, employees of the coalition base. I interviewed a number of people around the town afterwards who explained to me that I was surprised to hear, in fact, that they seemed to be most angry with as angry with the coalition forces as they were with the Taliban, because they said that if the coalition forces weren't patrolling in the city, they wouldn't have brought the Taliban attacks with them. I sense a great sort of sometimes confusion mixed with anger from people here who really have this sense of hopelessness that the security situation is so bad, the central government seems to be slightly powerless to improve it right now, even though, having said that, coalition forces have carried out a number of successful raids on Taliban hideouts. But people still feel intimidated and frightened, and they're somehow blaming it on the foreign presence. So in that sense, the Taliban tactics do seem to be working. They're sort of fragmenting support for both foreigners and the central government. And people really just say that their principal priority at the moment is peace, and everything else will follow after that.
We're talking to Declan Walsh. He's in Kandahar, correspondent for the London Guardian. The Washington Post is reporting that the U.S. military has carried out 340 airstrikes in Afghanistan over the last 3 months. That's more than double the number of airstrikes conducted in Iraq during the same period. How does it affect life there, Declan Walsh? People, I think of Afghanistan as very much the smaller war. More than double the number of airstrikes happening in Iraq at the same time.
That's right. I mean, this statistic, if you like, really illustrates what the strength is of the foreign military presence here. The American numbers are relatively small here. There's approximately 20,000 American troops, approximately 10,000 NATO-led troops, but that's a number that's increasing at the moment as NATO takes control of the southern provinces. But those troops are mostly garrisoned in central locations in the main cities, with a much smaller number of small bases in the countryside. What that means in practice is that when the coalition troops find themselves engaging with the Taliban in a rural area, what frequently happens, or increasingly frequently happens, is that they will locate the Taliban, locate a building where they think they're hiding out, and then call in these pummeling airstrikes, which take out the entire compound effectively. It's really an open question at the moment about whether the net effect of these military strikes is positive or not. According to the military, they take out senior Taliban figures, even though it's often very difficult to verify. On the other hand, in these rural areas where people, if you like, are fence-sitters, they're wavering between support for the Taliban or the government, they take these airstrikes as really, if you like, an infringement of their rights. They see them as terrifying. And, of course, the issue of civilian casualties is something that's coming to the fore, because there's often difficult to know, but often in the dozens of people who are killed in these strikes, that sort of frustration about civilian casualties is something that surfaced in the capital, Kabul, about 3 weeks ago, when an American military vehicle crashed just north of the center of the city, triggered riots that spread across all of Kabul for the day and left about a dozen people dead. So that's just a measure, if you like, of the sort of tensions among the population here, who, you know, I think most people do not want the Taliban, and I don't think they support the Taliban, but they are, if you like, angry by the relatively high level of civilian casualties from these airstrikes.
You got a hold of a report for your newspaper, the London Guardian, from the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, a 220-page report that had been shelved for over a year and a half, accusing Afghan MPs of torture and massacre. Can you go into that?
It's a report that was commissioned as part of the drive for what's termed as transitional justice here. It's a process by which Afghans will, if you like, come to terms with the many war crimes and atrocities that were committed over the 23 years of war, or serious war, between 1978 and 1991. This report was commissioned really to establish a baseline of facts, a baseline record of what happened during that period. The controversial part of it, of course, is that many of the figures who are named, the Mujahideen and Taliban's other militia commanders, particularly the Mujahideen commanders who are named in this report, are still in positions of great influence in society today. Some of them are members of the parliament that was elected last October. Other ones, there's a small number who are officials in the president's cabinet. And one of the most controversial figures, Abdul Rasul Sayaf, is a commander from an area just outside Kabul, who now leads a pro-Karzai group within the new parliament. And, of course, this parliament really has been vaunted as a sign of the great success of Afghanistan's rejuvenation since 2001. So this report was finished approximately 18 months ago, was due to be released at that point in January 2005, and, if you like, has effectively been buried ever since. The UN have continually postponed releasing it, and some of the people who have been involved in the production of the report have suggested to me that they feel that the UN, along with the Afghan government, has been avoiding publication of the report because of the sensitivities about naming these people, who have given no reckoning for their actions during the various conflicts over the years.
Is Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer. there seems to be a consensus that Osama bin Laden is somewhere along the Pakistan-Afghan border. Both countries regularly trade accusations that Osama is on the other side. But at this point, Western officials mostly seem to believe that, in fact, Osama is probably sheltering on the Pakistan side. And there's a tribal belt that runs all along the Afghan border. That is, in some ways, much more lawless than on the Afghan side. There's a large Western troop presence on the Afghan side, whereas on the Pakistan side, it's mostly run by tribal law. The Pakistan army and government has a very tenuous grip on these places. So there seems to be a consensus that the greater probability, if you like, is that Osama bin Laden is hiding on the Pakistan side of the border. But having said that, really, it's all speculation. Nobody has any good idea, and if anybody who does know certainly isn't saying at the moment.
Declan Walsh, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Correspondent with the London Guardian, joining us online from Kandahar. We'll link at our website, democracynow.org, to your series of pieces that you've been doing while in Afghanistan. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll go to New Orleans. Stay with us.
چنوی رخی بانو پخندل رات دشمنانو پر زای بدید کتل رات زمازانو بار چیر غاش چچل رات جارد شمجا کراپور دکی لخیال شد شمان یار سر مال مستاد استرگو شک قربان یار استله مشیخ دای دراو لگران یار
Ghazni Chant by Shar Mohammad Ghaznavi here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to New Orleans to look at the ongoing efforts to rebuild the city in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. After the storm hit, New Orleans infrastructure was virtually wiped out. Public housing units, hospitals, schools, universities shut down because of physical damage. But many of these public institutions have not been reopened, and some contend this is part of an effort to privatize New Orleans. We first look at the New Orleans public school system. Immediately after Hurricane Katrina hit, the Louisiana State Legislature voted to take over most of the city's public schools and effectively fire the 7,500 teachers who worked in them. The city schools are now part of the state-run Recovery School District, and control of these schools is being given to private charter organizations. Just last week, the Secretary of Education, Margaret Spellings, announced $24 million in federal aid to Louisiana for development of private charter schools, which doubles the amount the state has already received. This federal grant was made only to charter schools, not traditional public schools. Many parents and teachers have expressed concern. The move towards private charter schools is being done with little public discussion about curriculum, the efficacy of the schools, and working conditions for teachers. Joe DeRose is on the line with us now from New Orleans, joins us in the studios of WLAE. He's a communications director for the United Teachers of New Orleans. We invited a member of the Louisiana Board of Elementary and Secondary Education to join us, but they declined our request. Joe DeRose, can you start off by telling us about the firing of the teachers? I don't think most people in this country understand they were all fired.
Exactly. And first of all, I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity to tell this very sad story. You're right. Every teacher in New Orleans was fired. There weren't 7,500. There were 7,500 school employees, everybody from cafeteria workers, truck drivers, and custodians to teachers, and there were about 4,000 teachers. solid middle class employees, career professionals who had dedicated their careers to helping try to educate the children in one of the neediest cities in the country, a city with one of the highest poverty rates, as everybody saw in the days immediately following Katrina. They were treated with utter disrespect. There was no notification that they would be fired until one day in October when the school board called a press conference, notified us about an hour before that they were going to have such a conference. Therefore, most people found out that they were being terminated on the 5 o'clock news. Those who didn't have TVs or weren't still living in the city found out in the newspaper the next morning or by phone calls from friends and relatives who were in touch with the media.
And so what happened through this year? And what percentage of the public schools, are we talking over 90% of the schools are African American?
Yes, it was probably closer to 95%. And we also have a class division within the city where many African Americans of means, middle class African Americans, were able to send their children to, or chose to send their children to, Catholic schools. So New Orleans public schools were left with really the most impoverished students, and they were also in the buildings with terrible conditions, a school system that was not really adequately supported. There was not enough money. Nobody has ever determined how much money is needed to properly educate children in the state of Louisiana, for one, and certainly not in the city of New Orleans. If people had seen before Katrina the conditions of these schools, they would have been appalled. In fact, there was a group of people from the great city schools who came in October to evaluate the damage caused by Katrina. And because these people were experienced and because they were visiting schools mostly on the unflooded West Bank of New Orleans, they could tell the difference between hurricane damage and previously existing damage. And they were astonished at the conditions that that the city provided for its public school students.
We're talking to Joe DeRose, spokesperson for the United Teachers of New Orleans. So what happens now, and how many public schools have been opened? And what does the Spellings announcement mean for this tens of millions of dollars going into charter schools?
Well, as far as the number of schools that are opened, there are, before Katrina, there were about 116 schools that were run by the New Orleans by the Orleans Parish School Board. Now there are four. There are about 25 schools that have been designated, given charter status by the Orleans Parish School Board, and another 88 or 90 or so that that have been taken over by the state and will be run under what's called the Recovery School District, under the direct authority of the state. There was a long delay in opening any schools, and there is a strong feeling, which we think is valid, that there was a concerted effort to not reopen the schools. The very first announcement given by the state superintendent of education at the first meeting of the state board after the hurricane, he announced that schools in New Orleans and St. Bernard Parish would not open for the rest of the year. The president of United Teachers of New Orleans made an impassioned plea to reevaluate that decision, that there were people who were living in the city whose houses were not damaged, that deserved an education, and that there were people who would want to come back to the city that needed some hope that there would be schools open. So the first school opened after we filed a suit. It opened in, I think, the first or second week of November. I think it was the second week of November. One school opened in December, and then a third school opened in January. We continued to push our suit, saying that enough schools were not open in the city to provide an education for all the children who were still living here. And with the protest from officials that, yes, there were seats for every child that wanted to go to school. Well, that was not true. And the proof of that came as late as April, when they opened three more schools under pressure of our suit, and those schools filled up immediately. Another problem with delay in the schools, and which really not only hurt teachers but hurt children, the students of the city, and the families who wanted to return, is that the schools that were opened were pretty much confined to two geographical areas of the city, the Uptown area and the West Bank. But there were many children who were living on the other side of the French Quarter, in the neighborhoods on the other side of the French Quarter. And that's a distance of, you know, anywhere from 5 to maybe 12 miles to go to those schools. No transportation was provided for the students. And parents, even if there was transportation, parents are going to be reluctant to send, especially the elementary school children, to a strange neighborhood 10 or 12 miles away.
Going to Spelling's
announcement that more money was going to be provided for, more money is going to be provided for charter schools. This reinforces the belief that charter schools were a primary objective of post-Katrina New Orleans in the eyes of many officials. We've got to ask where was the federal help in the pre-existing school system, in the schools like I described, school buildings like I described.
Joe DeRosa, just on a side note, I remember when the president's mother, the former first lady Barbara Bush, went to visit the Katrina survivors in the Houston Astrodome, and she promised to make a contribution to charity. I'm looking at the Houston Chronicle, the piece that wrote about that, and said Katrina funds earmarked to pay for Neil Bush's software program. Former first lady Barbara Bush donated an undisclosed amount of money to the Bush-Clinton-Katrina Fund, with specific instructions that the money be spent with an educational software company owned by her son, Neil. Since then, the Ignite Learning Program has been given to 8 area schools that took in substantial numbers of Hurricane Katrina evacuees that was in Houston. Do you know more about that? At the time, we didn't know that she was saying that her charitable contribution would go to pay for her son's educational software.
No, I don't know anything about that, but I think the point is that that really needs to be looked at very hard, is that a lot of money has been allocated, maybe not enough, but certainly billions of dollars have already been allocated by the federal government, and I think it's pretty important to look at where that money is being spent, and I think that maybe in other parts of this discussion with Mr. Quigley later on that you, you know, might want to talk about that even more.
Well, let me ask you what's happened to these teachers, the 4,000 teachers that were fired, mm-hmm. and the other school workers, 7,500 employees. For example, health benefits, are they covered?
This is the thing that has been, I don't want to say most traumatic, because losing a job after dedicating a career to a school system and to a city was very traumatic in itself. But it's been very significant. When the board decided to fire all these teachers, it changed the risk pool of people that were in the insurance pool. So now, instead of having thousands of active employees, many of which were younger, and you had a broader spectrum across the age range, you were left with mostly retirees who in the insurance pool, people who had previously retired before Katrina. And then you also had an influx of new retirees, because the only way that people who are in the school system can maintain insurance benefits after leaving the school district is if they retire. They would not be allowed to retain benefits if they were terminated. So many teachers were in this caught between a rock and a hard place when the termination notice went out, that they had to choose between retiring, even if they weren't ready and still loved teaching and wanted to go back to their schools, or to retire so that they could maintain benefits. So you had the influx of probably 1,000 or 1,500 employees, maybe more, into the to the insurance pool on top of all the retirees who had retired in years and decades past. The skewing of the insurance pool meant that the rates had to be recalculated. And rates for a retiree, for a single retiree, went from $200 a month to over $600 a month. Now, if you were a teacher, maybe you're making a retirement of $20,000 if you're newly retired, maybe less than that. And $7,000 of that is going to go to insurance. That's pretty unaffordable. But it's even worse if you were a teacher's aide or a secretary or a cafeteria worker. Some of those people would not even bring home in retirement, in a pension, what they would have to pay in insurance costs.
Joe, you lost everything in the hurricane?
Yes, like many other people, I lost everything. We're trying to rebuild. I'm still living in Baton Rouge, as so many people are. I'm lucky enough to be living in Baton Rouge, which is only a little more than an hour away. There are people I know, there are teachers who are living in many other states, a lot in Mississippi, Texas, Alabama, Florida, who dying to get back, but it's difficult, especially if they went and actually were able to get another job, which was difficult because the school year had already begun in the South. Some of those people, probably just getting back with the end of the school year to try to rebuild their house.
Joe DeRose, I want to thank you for being with us, spokesperson for United Teachers of New Orleans. When we come back, we'll be joined by Bill Quigley in the studios of WLAE in New Orleans, who wrote a piece called Bulldozing Hope, HUD to New Orleans Poor, Go Find Yourself Housing. Stay with us. Forever by New Orleans jazz artist and educator Kid Jordan. It was recorded 3 weeks after Hurricane Katrina destroyed his home. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 450 radio and television stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, on low-power FM college and community radio stations, on public access TV, on PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375 Link TV. And we are video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. We turn now to look at the situation with public housing in New Orleans. Last week, federal housing officials announced that more than 5,000 public housing units for the poor were to be demolished, even though tens of thousands of low-income residents remain displaced. On Saturday, public housing residents and advocates protested the decision by the Department of Housing and Urban Development and vowed to use any means necessary to stop the bulldozing of their homes. The HUD decision means that at least 3,000 families who lived in the units before the storm will have to find someplace else to go. If the federal government's plan goes forward, New Orleans will have lost 85% of its public housing over the last decade. Last week, the Deputy Chief of Staff of HUD, Scott Keller, attended a meeting of the New Orleans City Council. After the meeting, Free Speech Radio News correspondent Christian Roseland asked him if now was the right time to be tearing down public housing, since there are still over 200,000 people displaced from the hurricane. This was Scott Keller's response.
The most important thing is that you're able to come home to a safe and hazard-free environment. These buildings are not that way. These buildings are mold-infested. These buildings are falling down. These buildings are not the type of buildings that you would even warehouse your furniture in if you had to move out. These buildings are terrible. They are nothing to be proud of. They are something that is an icon of failed federal policy. We need to make sure that what we build, that what we invest in this community, the taxpayers of this country who are putting billions of dollars down here, that what we're putting back is something that is building families and building communities.
Scott Keller at a meeting last week of the New Orleans City Council of HUD, the Housing and Urban Development Department in Washington, D.C. To talk more about this, we're joined now by Bill Quigley. He's a law professor at Loyola University in New Orleans, also the director of the Law Clinic and Gillis Long Poverty Law Center at Loyola University. His most recent article is on the website Counterpunch. It's entitled Bulldozing Hope, HUD to New Orleans Poor, Go Find Yourself Housing. Welcome to Democracy Now! Bill.
Welcome, Amy. Thank you.
It's good to have you back and to be with you in the studios of WLAE in New Orleans, where we broadcast from when we were in New Orleans. Talk about the whole plan for public housing.
Well, it's HUD, it's hypocritical urban demolition, really, is what HUD stands for. The federal government in New Orleans has been in the business of demolishing and destroying housing. And what's happening in New Orleans right now is such an outrage at a time of our biggest affordable housing crisis ever that the federal government has decided that they are going to destroy 5,000 units of public housing. Is a disgrace. We have people in this town that are living in abandoned housing, that are living in houses without electricity and water, that don't even have completely fixed up roofs. And what HUD is doing here is part of a national policy to destroy public housing and replace it with this euphemism of mixed income housing, which is translated for the people who live there, means they take conventional public housing, destroy it, and then allow about 10% of the people who used to live there to come back. But it is a great bonanza for developers, for real estate people, for banks, for construction groups, and the like. The public housing in New Orleans is actually some of the most structurally sound property that we have in this entire city. And the attack is not really on the buildings. It's not really about the housing. It is an attack on the people who live in the buildings. The people who live in the buildings, the poor, as you heard earlier, the people who attend the public schools, the people who need the health care and the like, those people who are our sisters and brothers, those people who are the working poor that keep our community together, those people are being attacked on every front, from public education, public housing, employment, public health care, and the like. And this is just shows that they have, that the federal government has no shame whatsoever that they would demolish houses under these circumstances. The important thing I want to say, though, is that the residents are not just taking this. They had a march this past weekend where they marched to an upper income community, said, look, if you want to mix, let's do mixed income. Let's mix income your community, you know? And they held a big banner in front of a $2 million house, said, look, if we're going to start mixed income, let's start here. They have set up a survivor's village, a tent city, outside of a 1,300-unit apartment called the St. Bernard Housing Development. And on July 4th, which I think is a really important time, on July 4th, they have vowed that if the federal government and local government doesn't let them back into their houses at this 1,300-unit apartment complex, where they have put up fences and barbed wire net, that on July 4th, they are going to liberate their own houses and go back, because that's what's going to be necessary in order to be able to take back this city and take back opportunities for the people who built this city, whose culture permeates this city, who have kept this city alive. There's not room for them in the plans that are going forward.
As you talk about this plan they have to liberate their own housing, maybe you could comment on the National Guard coming back to New Orleans and patrolling the streets.
Yes, the the mayor, the governor, the city council, and those folks have asked for and have received a large number of National Guard, large number of state police, and that is their response. We had a tragic murder over the weekend where five young men under the age of 19 were killed, and it's a horrifying thing. I think, though, it's very important to know one of those young men worked at a fast food place, and he was working at a fast food place because he had not been able to get back into school. He had shown back up in the spring, and he was not able to get back into school because they said they didn't have room for him and he should just go ahead and start in the fall. If you don't have schools, if you don't have housing, if you don't have health care, if you don't have electricity, don't have water, then, you know, there is a point at which people are not going to respond accordingly. So the response of the community has not been, let's reinvest in our public education system. It has not been, let's reinvest in our housing system. It has not been reinvest in health care. It is, let's get some more troops in this town to try to prevent the looting and the things that are, the bad things that are happening. Certainly people need protection. Certainly security is part of it. But you just can't do that. You cannot privatize every public institution that we have and just make it available for people with money and expect the rest of the people just to sit back or not come home or just allow themselves to be victimized over and over and over again. It's not going to happen.
You quote the Republican Congress member Richard Baker, 10-term Republican from Baton Rouge, telling lobbyists when Katrina displaced New Orleans public housing residents. He said, "We finally cleaned up public housing in New Orleans. We couldn't do it, but God did."
Yes. You know, and sadly, that is the position of an awful lot of our elected officials and a lot of our local power elite, is that they blame the problems of New Orleans on the people who are the number one victims of the problems of New Orleans. They blame the kids with disabilities for having problems in school when they're not properly placed. The jails are full. Now they're blaming the judges for not putting higher bonds on people when we've had three jury trials in our criminal law system since last August. Our criminal law system is broken along with all the rest of these things. And all it's about is blaming the victims. And I think there's a real lesson here for the rest of us in the United States, because what's happening in the lower Ninth Ward, what's happening in New Orleans with Katrina, is graphic and it's illustrative because it's so condensed and it's so easy to see. But these same exact forces of privatization, of imposing stigmas on poor people, of keeping people out of neighborhoods, of destroying our public housing, destroying public health care, destroying public education. Those things are happening in every community across this country, and there is a real lesson here for people. Not only should they give us solidarity in New Orleans, because we need that, particularly on July 4th for the next thing, but to understand that what is happening to New Orleans is what we have done to the people of Iraq, what we have done as a country to places outside of our country, and what we are doing maybe slower, a little more subtly, in every major city in this country. The people of New Orleans say, you know, if our government is treating us this way, can you imagine how they are treating the people of Iraq? Can you imagine how they're treating the people of Afghanistan? Can you imagine what's going on in Central and Latin America? And there is a lesson here, is a teaching lesson for us about the priorities of our country, the priorities of the people in power, and the way that they are willing to marginalize and just discard the needs of poor and working folks in this community, but in communities all across this country. Why do we have a minimum wage of $5.15 an hour, you know, in this day and age in the richest country in the history of the world? Why do we have people that are living in abandoned housing without electricity, without water, and at the same time we are going to destroy 5,000 units of public housing? This is a disgrace. But these people are saying they're doing it for our good. They're doing it because they know what's better. It's paternalism. It's so-called tough love. It is an attack on the people who built this country and the people who built our communities.
Bill Quigley, law professor at Loyola University. A census was done looking at the 4 months after the Hurricane Katrina that found New Orleans has become considerably whiter, older, less poor. Not because people have more money there, but because those who are poorer are no longer there. Do you think that there is a kind of plan here to use New Orleans as a social experiment to look at a privatized city in this country?
I think absolutely that there is. New Orleans has become the national laboratory for charter schools. We have more charter schools than we have anything else, and that's continuing to grow. We have become the laboratory for destruction of a public health care system. We are now at the point where we are the laboratory for the destruction of public housing. Every one of our public institutions that were destroyed have not been rebuilt, and that is done consciously in an attempt to privatize everything. And privatization makes sense for people who have resources. It makes sense for people who want to own those resources, but it does not make sense for people who have a sense of community, of the common good, and a role of government to provide an opportunity for people who are left out of the normal maximization of profit forces that are in the market. And New Orleans, if people don't understand it, what is happening to New Orleans is coming to your community. Maybe it's going to come slower. Maybe it's going to come a little more subtle, but it is the laboratory to take what the lessons that our country is imposing on the rest of the world and to plant them in the United States, and they are calling them success. That's the thing. They are destroying our community. They are displacing our elderly, our disabled, our poor, and they are saying it is success, and this is what we have to do in order to save ourselves.
Bill Quigley, the black population in New Orleans has gone from over a third of the population being black to just about a fifth of the population. What about the right of return? Do you see people returning?
Well, the numbers aren't exactly correct. It was about two-thirds, a little over two-thirds black, and it's a little bit less than 50% at this point. But everybody is asking for the right to return. They're starting to demand the right to return. The people who are back, who, as you said, are whiter, more affluent, more old than the way the city was before, they're perfectly happy with the city that they have now. And they do not want their quality of life diminished or diluted by letting back in those people. And those people are the people who are in public schools. Those people are the people who are in public housing. Those people are the people who need public health care. But those people are also the people who clean our streets, clean our hotels, cook our food, take care of our parents, are the cashiers, are the servers, are the waitresses, the working folks who keep our lives together. So we want their services, but we don't want to have them live in our community anymore. And so it has a racial angle, has a very definite class angle, and it also has a significant corporate privatization angle as well.
Bill Quigley, I want to thank you for being with us. If people want to follow what's happening in New Orleans, read articles, learn about projects that are there for rebuilding, is there a place you can recommend that they go on the web?
There are a couple of places they could go. There's a one called justiceforneworleans.org, which is all one word. Common Ground Collective maintains information on that.
Bill Quigley,
well. And I would say,
we'll link to these sites at democracynow.org. And I want to thank you
so
very
much
for being with us, law professor at Loyola University, director of the Law Clinic and the Gillis Law Long Poverty Center at Loyola. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdo-Kadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Mate, Frank Lopez, Mike DeFilippo, and Nick Marsilio, our engineers. Also, special thanks to Uri Gallet, our director. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.